2.3 His grandfather called it a curious interregnum, meaning a time that stood between two other times, a time of no time, when all the rules about how you were supposed to live had been thrown out the window. And even though the fatherless boy understood that it couldn't last forever, he wished it could have gone on longer than the 2 months he had been given. Another 2 months on top of the first two, perhaps, or another 6 months, or maybe even a year. It had been good to live in that time of no school, that curious gap between one life and the next, when his mother was with him from the second he opened his eyes in the morning until the second he closed them at night. For she was the only person who felt real to him anymore, the only real person left in the world. And how good it had been to share those days and weeks with her, those strange 2 months of eating out in restaurants and visiting empty apartments and going to the movies nearly every afternoon. So many movies watched together in the darkness of the balcony, where they could cry whenever they wanted to and not have to explain themselves to anyone. His mother called it wallowing in the mud, and by that Ferguson supposed she meant the mud of their unhappiness. But sinking into that unhappiness could be eerily satisfying, he discovered, as long as you sank into it as far as you could and weren't afraid to drown. And because the tears kept pushing them back into the past, they had protected them from having to think about the future. But then one day his mother said it was time to start thinking about it, and the crying came to an end. Unfortunately, school was inevitable. Much as Ferguson would have wished to prolong his freedom, it was not in his power to control such things. And once he and his mother decided to rent the apartment on Central Park West, the next order of business was to place him in a good private school. Public school was out of the question. Aunt Mildred was emphatic about that point, and in a rare instance of accord between the sisters, Ferguson's mother followed her advice, knowing that Mildred was better informed on matters of education than she was. And why throw Archie onto the rugged asphalt of a public school playground when she could afford the expense of private school tuition? She only wanted what was best for her boy, and New York had turned into a grimmer, more dangerous city than the one she had left in 1944, with youth gangs roaming the streets of the Upper West Side, armed with switchblades and deadly zip guns, just 25 blocks north of where her parents lived, and yet another universe, a neighborhood that had been transformed by the influx of Puerto Rican immigrants in the past few years. A dirtier, poorer, more colorful place than it had been during the war, the air now charged with unfamiliar smells and sounds, a different sort of energy animating the sidewalks on Columbus and Amsterdam Avenues. One had only to step outdoors to feel an undercurrent of menace and confusion. And Ferguson's mother, who had always felt so comfortable in New York as a child and young woman, worried about her son's safety. The second half of the curious interregnum was consequently devoted to more than just shopping for furniture and going to the movies. There were also the half-dozen private schools on Mildred's list to be looked at and discussed, the tours of classrooms and facilities, the interviews with headmasters and admissions directors, the IQ tests and entrance exams, and when Ferguson was accepted by Mildred's number one choice, the Hilliard School for Boys, there was such rejoicing in the family, such a wave of warmth and enthusiasm washing over him from his grandparents and his mother and his aunt and uncle and his great-aunt Pearl, that the nearly 8-year-old fatherless boy figured school might not be such a bad way to pass the time after all. It wasn't going to be easy to fit in, of course, not when it was late February and the school year was almost 2/3 finished, and it wasn't going to be fun having to wear a jacket and tie every day. But perhaps it wouldn't be a problem, and perhaps he would begin to get used to the clothes. But even if it was a problem, and he didn't get used to the clothes, it wasn't going to make any difference, for he was on his way to the Hilliard School for Boys, whether he liked it or not. He went there because Aunt Mildred had convinced his mother that Hilliard was one of the best schools in the city, with a long-standing reputation for academic excellence. But no one had told Ferguson that his fellow students would be among the richest children in America, the scions of privileged old-money New York. or that he would be the only boy in his class who lived on the West Side, and one of only 11 non-Christians in a school with a K-12 enrollment of nearly 600. At first, no one suspected he was anything other than a Scottish Presbyterian, an understandable error in light of the name his grandfather had been given after the Rockefeller bungle of 1900. But then, one of the teachers noticed that Ferguson's lips weren't moving when he was supposed to be saying, "Jesus Christ, our Lord," at morning chapel. And word eventually got out that he was one of the 11 and not one of the 576. Add in the fact that he entered the school as a latecomer, a mostly silent boy with no ties to anyone in the class, and it would appear that Ferguson's tenure at Hilliard was doomed from the start, doomed before he even set foot in the building on his first day. It wasn't that anyone was unkind to him, or that anyone harassed him, or that he was made to feel unwelcome. As with every other school, there were friendly boys and neutral boys and nasty boys. But not even the nastiest among them ever taunted Ferguson for being a Jew. Hilliard might have been a stuffy, jacket-and-tie sort of place, but it also preached tolerance and the virtues of gentlemanly self-control. And any act of overt prejudice would have been dealt with harshly by the authorities. More subtly and more confusingly, what Ferguson had to contend with was a guileless sort of ignorance that seemed to have been injected into his classmates at birth. Even Doug Hayes, the ever amiable and good-hearted Dougie Hayes, who had made a point of befriending Ferguson from the moment he arrived at Hilliard, who had been the first boy to invite him to a birthday party, and had subsequently asked him over to his parents' townhouse on East 78th Street no fewer than a dozen times, could still ask, after having known Ferguson for 9 months, what he was planning to do on Thanksgiving. "Eat turkey," Ferguson said. "That's what we do every year. My mother and I go to my grandparents' apartment and eat turkey with stuffing and gravy." "Oh," Dougie said, "I had no idea." "Why not?" Ferguson answered. "Isn't that what you do?" "Of course. I just didn't know your people celebrated Thanksgiving." "My people? You know, Jewish people. Why wouldn't we celebrate Thanksgiving?" "Because it's a kind of an American thing, I guess. The Pilgrims, Plymouth Rock, all those English guys with the funny black hats who came over on the Mayflower." Ferguson was so bewildered by Dougie's comment that he didn't know what to say. Until that moment, it had never occurred to him that he might not be an American, or, more precisely, that his way of being an American was any less authentic than the way Dougie and the other boys were American. But that was what his friend seemed to be asserting, that there was a difference between them, an elusive, indefinable quality that had to do with black-hatted English ancestors and the length of time spent on this side of the ocean, and the money to live in four-story townhouses on the Upper East Side that made some families more American than others. And in the end, the difference was so great that the less American families could barely be considered American at all. No doubt his mother had chosen the wrong school for him. But in spite of that perplexing conversation about Jewish dining habits on national feast days, not to mention other perplexing moments both before and after his talk with Dougie H., Ferguson never felt any desire to leave Hilliard. Even if he failed to grasp the peculiar customs and beliefs of the world he had entered, he did his best to comply with them. And not once did he blame his mother or Aunt Mildred for having sent him there. He had to go somewhere, after all. The law said that every child under the age of 16 had to go to school. And as far as he was concerned, Hilliard was no better or no worse than any other penitentiary for the young. It wasn't the school's fault that he did so badly there. In those bleak early days following Stanley Ferguson's death, young Ferguson had concluded that he was living in an upside-down universe of infinitely reversible propositions. Day equals night, hope equals despair, power equals weakness. Which meant that when it came to the question of school, he was now obliged to fail rather than succeed. And given how good it felt not to care anymore, to court failure as a matter of principle, and will himself in the comforting arms of humiliation and defeat, it was all but certain that he would have failed just as gloriously anywhere else. His teachers found him quote, lazy and unmotivated, indifferent to authority, distracted, stubborn, shockingly undisciplined, a human puzzle, unquote. The boy who had answered every question on the entrance exam correctly, who had won over the admissions director with his sweet nature and precocious insights, the late-in-the-year add-on, who was supposed to bring home top marks in every subject, earned only one excellent on his first report card, which was issued in April of his second grade year. The subject was gym. A grade of good for reading, writing, and penmanship, he had tried to do worse, but he was still a beginner at masking his talents. Satisfactory in music, he couldn't resist belting out the Negro spirituals and Irish folk songs that Mr. Bowles taught them, even though he struggled to stay in tune. And poor in everything else, which included math, science, art, social studies, comportment, citizenship, and attitude. The next and final report card, which was issued in June, was almost identical to the first, the only difference being his grade in math, which descended from poor to fail. He had perfected the art of giving wrong answers to arithmetic questions by then. 3 out of every 5 on average, but he still couldn't bring himself to misspell more than a tenth of his words. Under normal circumstances, Ferguson would not have been asked back for the following year. His work had been so hideously subpar as to suggest profound psychological trouble. And a school like Hilliard was not accustomed to carrying dead weight, at least not when the flunker came from a non-legacy family. Legacy meaning a third or fourth or fifth generation boy whose father wrote out a check every year or sat on the board of trustees. They were willing to give Ferguson another chance, however, for they understood that his circumstances were anything but normal. Mr. Ferguson had died in the middle of the school year, a sudden, violent death that had sent the boy spinning into the nether zones of grief and disintegration, and surely he deserved a little more time to pull himself together. He had too much potential for them to give up on him after just 3.5 months, and therefore they informed Ferguson's mother that her son would have one more year to prove himself. If he could turn it around by then, he would no longer be on probation. If not, well, that would be that, and good luck to him wherever he happened to land. Ferguson hated himself for having disappointed his mother, whose life was hard enough without having to fret about his rotten performance at school. But there were more important issues at stake than trying to please her or bending over backward to impress the family with a report card full of excellence and very goods. He knew that life would have been simpler for him and everyone else if he had towed the line and done what was expected of him. How easy and thoroughly uncomplicated it would have been to stop giving wrong answers on purpose, to begin paying attention again, and make everyone proud of him for being such a conscientious boy. But Ferguson had embarked on a grand experiment, a secret investigation into the most fundamental matters concerning life and death. And he couldn't turn back now. He was traveling down a rough and perilous road, alone among the rocks and twisting mountain paths, in danger of falling off the precipice at any moment. But until enough information had been gathered to provide him with conclusive results, he would have to go on putting himself at risk, even if it meant being expelled from the Hilliard School for Boys, even if it meant turning himself into a disgrace. The question was, why had God stopped talking to him? And if God was silent now, did that mean he would be silent forever, or eventually start talking to him again? And if he never talked again, could it mean that Ferguson had deluded himself and God had never been there in the first place? For as long as he could remember, the voice had been in his head, talking to him whenever he was alone, a quiet, measured voice that was at once reassuring and commanding, a baritone murmur bearing the verbal emanations of the great invisible spirit who ruled the world. And Ferguson had always felt comforted by that voice, protected by that voice, which told him that as long as he kept up his end of the bargain, all would go well for him, his end being an eternal promise to be good, to treat others with kindness and generosity, and to obey the holy commandments, which meant never lying or stealing or succumbing to envy, which meant loving his parents and working hard at school and staying out of trouble. And Ferguson believed in the voice and did his best to follow its instructions at all times. And since God seemed to be keeping up his end of the bargain by making things go well for him, Ferguson felt loved and happy, secure in the knowledge that God believed in him just as much as he believed in God. So it went until he was 7 and a half. And then, one morning in early November, a morning that felt no different from any other morning, his mother walked into his room and told him his father was dead, and everything suddenly changed. God had lied to him. The great invisible spirit could no longer be trusted. And even though he went on talking to Ferguson for the next several days, asking for another chance to prove himself, beseeching the fatherless boy to stay with him, quote, through this dark time of death and mourning, unquote, Ferguson was so angry at him that he refused to listen. Then, 4 days after the funeral, the voice abruptly went silent, and since that day it hadn't spoken again. That was the challenge now, to figure out whether God was still with him in the silence or whether he had vanished from his life for good. Ferguson didn't have the heart to commit a knowing act of cruelty. He couldn't bring himself to lie or cheat or steal. He had no inclination to hurt or offend his mother. But within the narrow scope of misdeeds he was capable of, he understood that the only way to answer the question was to break his end of the bargain as often as he could, to defy the injunction, to follow the holy commandments, and then wait for God to do something bad to him, something nasty and personal, that would serve as a clear sign of intended retribution. A broken arm, an attack of boils on his face, a rabid dog biting off a chunk of his leg. If God failed to punish him, that would prove he had indeed disappeared when the voice stopped talking. And since God was supposedly everywhere, in every tree and blade of grass, in every gust of wind and human feeling, it made no sense that he could disappear from one place and still be everywhere else. He necessarily had to be with Ferguson because he was in all places at the same time. And if he was absent from the place where Ferguson happened to be, that could only mean that he was in no place and had never been in any place at all. That he, in fact, had never existed, and the voice Ferguson had taken for the voice of God had been none other than his own voice speaking to him in an inner conversation with himself. The first act of revolt had been tearing up the Ted Williams baseball card, the precious card that Jeff Balsoni had slipped into his hand a couple of days after he returned to school as a gesture of undying friendship and commiseration. How disgusting it had been to destroy that gift, and how shameful it had been to turn his eyes away from Mrs. Costello and pretend she hadn't been there. And now that he was at Hilliard, how unconscionable it was for him to be pursuing his campaign of willful self-sabotage, building on his efforts of the first year to establish a new pattern of maddeningly inconsistent results. A far more effective strategy than one of pure failure, he decided. A 100% on 2 math tests in a row, for example, and then 25% on the next, 40% on the one after that, and then 90% followed by a dead last zero. How mystified they all were by him, his teachers and classmates alike, not to mention his poor mother and the rest of his family. And yet, even though Ferguson continued to spit on the rules of responsible human behavior, no dog had jumped up to bite him on the leg. No boulder had dropped on his foot. No slamming door had crushed his nose. And it seemed that God had no interest in punishing him. For Ferguson had been engaged in a life of crime for almost a year now, and still there wasn't a single scratch on him. That should have settled the matter once and for all, but it didn't. If God wouldn't punish him, that meant he couldn't punish him, and therefore he didn't exist. Or so Ferguson had assumed, but now that God was on the verge of being lost to him forever, he asked himself, what if he had already been punished enough? What if the killing of his father had been punishment on such a grand scale, a tragedy with such monstrous, everlasting effects, that God had decided to spare him from any other punishments in the future. That seemed possible to him, by no means certain, but possible. Yet with the voice still silent after so many months, Ferguson had no way of confirming his intuition. God had wronged him, and now he was struggling to make it up to Ferguson by treating him with divine gentleness and mercy. If the voice could no longer tell him what he needed to know, perhaps God could communicate with him in some other way, through some inaudible sign that would prove he was still listening to his thoughts. And so began the final stage of Ferguson's long theological inquiry, the months of silent prayer, when he begged God to reveal himself to him or else lose the right to bear the name of God. Ferguson wasn't asking for some grand biblical revelation, a mighty clap of thunder or a sudden parting of the seas. No, he would have been content with something small, an infinitesimal miracle that only he himself would have been aware of. For the wind to blow hard enough to push an errant scrap of paper across the street before the traffic light changed color. For his watch to stop ticking for 10 seconds and then start again. For a single drop of rain to fall from a cloudless sky and land on his finger. For his mother to say the word mysterious within the next 30 seconds. For the radio to turn on by itself. For 17 people to pass in front of the window within the next minute and a half. For the robin on the grass in Central Park to pull out a worm before the next plane passed overhead. For 3 cars to honk their horns at the same time. For the book in his hand to fall open to page 97. For the wrong date to appear on the front page of the morning paper. For a quarter to be lying next to his foot when he looked down at the sidewalk. For the Dodgers to score 3 runs in the bottom of the 9th and win the game. For his great Aunt Pearl's cat to wink at him. For everyone in the room to yawn at the same time. For everyone in the room to laugh at the same time. For no one in the room to make a sound for the next 33 1/3 seconds. One by one, Ferguson wished for those things to happen. Those things and many others as well. And when none of them happened over 6 months of wordless supplication, he stopped wishing for anything and turned his thoughts away from God. Years later, his mother confessed to him that for her too, the beginning had been less difficult than what came next. The curious interregnum had been almost bearable, she said. With so many urgent practical decisions to be made, the matter of selling her house and business in New Jersey, of finding a place to live in New York, of furnishing that place while she went about the job of putting Ferguson in a proper school, the sudden onslaught of obligations that fell down on her during the early days of her widowhood had not been a burden so much as a welcome distraction, a way of not having to think about the Newark fire every minute of her waking life. And thank God for all those movies, she added, and the darkness of the theaters on those cold winter days, and the chance to disappear into the make-believe of those dumb stories, and thank God for you too, Archie, she told him, my brave little man, my rock, my anchor. For the longest time, you were the only real person left in the world for me, and without you, what would I have done, Archie? What would I have lived for, and how on earth would I have been able to go on? No doubt she had been half-crazed during those months, she said, a mad woman fueled by cigarettes, coffee, and steady bursts of adrenaline. But once the questions of home and school had been answered, the whirlwind subsided and then stopped altogether, and she sank into a long period of thought and reflection. Horrible days, horrible nights, a time of numbness and indecision, when she weighed one possibility against another, and struggled to imagine where she wanted the future to take her. She was lucky in that regard, she said, lucky to be in a position to choose between alternatives. But the fact was that she had money now, more money than she had ever dreamed of having. $200,000 from the life insurance alone, not to mention the money she had collected from the sale of the Milburn house and Roseland photo, which included the additional sums she had earned from selling the furniture in the house and the equipment in the studio, and even after she deducted the thousands she had spent on the new furniture and the annual cost of sending Ferguson to private school and the monthly cost of renting the apartment, she had more than enough left over to do nothing for the next 12 or 15 years, to go on living off her dead husband until the day her son graduated from college. And far beyond that, if she found herself a clever stocks and bonds man and invested in the market. She was 33 years old, no longer a beginner in life, but hardly what one would call a has-been, and though it comforted her to muse on the blessings of her good fortune, to know that it was within her power to live a life of leisure well into her old age if she was of a mind to do that. As the months passed, and she continued to meditate and do nothing, her time mostly given over to traveling through Central Park 4 times a day on the crosstown bus, taking Ferguson to school in the morning, and then returning home, picking up Ferguson in the afternoon, and again returning home, and on the mornings when she couldn't bring herself to jump back on the bus and return to the west side, she would spend the 6.5 hours Ferguson was in school wandering around the east side, browsing alone in shops, lunching alone in restaurants, going to movies alone, going to museums alone, and after 3.5 months of that routine, followed by a strange, empty summer, holed up in a rented house on the Jersey Shore with her son, where they spent the bulk of their time indoors, watching television together, she discovered she was growing restless, itching to work again. It had taken her the better part of a year to reach that point, but once she got there, the Leica and the Rolleiflex finally came out of the closet, and before long Ferguson's mother was sailing on a ship headed back to the land of photography. She went about it differently this time, throwing herself out into the world rather than inviting the world to come to her, no longer interested in maintaining a studio at a fixed address, which she now felt was an outmoded way of doing photography, needlessly cumbersome in a time of rapid transformations, with new high-speed film stocks and ever more efficient, lightweight cameras overturning the field, making it possible to rethink her old ideas about light and composition, to reinvent herself and move beyond the limits of classical portraiture. And by the time Ferguson began his second year at Hilliard, his mother was already casting about for work, stumbling onto her first job in late September, when the man who had been hired to take pictures at her cousin Charlotte's wedding fell down a flight of stairs and broke his leg. And because there was only a week to go before the day of the wedding, she volunteered to fill in for him at no charge. The synagogue was out somewhere in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn, the old neighborhood of the first Archie and great Aunt Pearl. And between the marriage ceremony and the removal of the wedding party to a catering hall 2 blocks to the south, Ferguson's mother used her tripod to take formal black-and-white portraits of all the family members in attendance, the bride and groom to begin with, 29-year-old Charlotte, who had seemed destined never to marry anyone after her fiancé was killed in the Korean War, and 36-year-old widower-dentist Nathan Birnbaum, followed by great-aunt Pearl, Ferguson's Nana and Papa, Charlotte's twin sister Betty, and her accountant husband, Seymour Graff, Aunt Mildred, who was now teaching at Sarah Lawrence, and her husband, Paul Sandler, who worked as an editor at Random House, and finally Ferguson himself, in a picture with his 2 second cousins, Betty and Seymour's children, 5-year-old Eric and 3-year-old Judy. Once the party began at the catering hall, Ferguson's mother abandoned her tripod and spent the next 3.5 hours wandering among the guests, taking hundreds of pictures of the 96 people who were there. Unposed, spontaneous shots of old men in quiet conversation with one another, of young women laughing as they drank wine and shoveled food into their mouths, of children dancing with grown-ups and grown-ups dancing together after the meal was done. All the faces of all those people, captured in the natural light of that bare, unglamorous setting, the musicians perched on their small stage as they clanged forth their tired, corny songs, Great Aunt Pearl smiling as she kissed her granddaughter's cheek, Benji Adler whooping it up on the dance floor with a 20-year-old distant cousin from Canada, a frowning 9-year-old girl sitting alone at a table with a half-eaten piece of cake in front of her. And at one point during the festivities, Uncle Paul walked up to his sister-in-law and remarked that she seemed to be enjoying herself, that he hadn't seen her so happy and animated since she'd moved to New York. And Ferguson's mother simply said, "I have to do this, Paul. I'll go nuts if I don't start working again." To which Mildred's husband replied, "I think I can help you, Rose." Help came in the form of a commission to go to New Orleans and photograph Henry Wilmot for the dust jacket of his forthcoming novel, a much-anticipated work by the past winner of the Pulitzer Prize. And when the 62-year-old Wilmot told his editor how pleased he was with the results, that is, called Paul Sandler and informed him that from now on, no one but that, quote, beautiful woman would be allowed to take his picture, more commissions for author photos came in from Random House, which led to work for other New York publishers as well, which in turn led to magazine assignments for feature stories about writers, film directors, Broadway actors, musicians, and artists in Town and Country, Vogue, Look, Ladies Home Journal, The New York Times Magazine, and other weeklies and monthlies over the years that followed. Ferguson's mother always photographed her subjects in their own environments, traveling to the places where they lived and worked with her portable light stands, fold-up screens, and collapsible umbrellas, shooting writers in their book-filled studios or sitting behind their desks, painters in the tumult and splatter of their studios, pianists sitting behind or standing next to their gleaming black Steinways, actors looking into their dressing room mirrors or sitting alone on bare stages. And for some reason, her black and white portraits seem to capture more about the inner lives of those people than most photographers were able to extract from shooting those same well-known figures, a quality that had less to do with technical skill, perhaps, than with something about Ferguson's mother herself, who always prepared for her assignments by reading the books and listening to the records and looking at the paintings of her subjects, which gave her something to talk about with them during their long sessions together. And because she talked easily and was ever so charming and attractive, ever so not a person to talk about herself, those vain and difficult artists would find themselves relaxing in her presence, feeling that she was genuinely interested in who and what they were, which was in fact true, or mostly true most of the time. And once the seduction had taken effect and their guard had come down, the masks they wore on their faces would gradually slip off and a different sort of light would begin to emerge from their eyes. On top of this commercial work for magazines and book publishers, Ferguson's mother kept busy with her own projects, what she called her wandering eye explorations, which abandoned the meticulous control required to produce first-rate portraits for a come-what-may openness to chance encounters with the unexpected. She had discovered this contrary impulse in herself at her cousin Charlotte's wedding, that unpaid job from 1955 that had turned into an exuberant 3.5-hour binge of manic picture-taking as she spun her way through the crowd, freed from the restraints of laborious preparation, and plunged into a whirl of rapid-fire compositions, one picture succeeding the next, ephemeral instants that had to be caught precisely then or not at all. Pause for half a second, and the picture would be gone. And the ferocity of concentration called for under the circumstances had thrown her into a kind of emotional fever, as if every face and body in the room had been rushing in on her at once, as if every person there were breathing inside her eyes, no longer on the other side of the camera, but within her, an inseparable part of who she was. Predictably enough, Charlotte and her husband hated those photographs. Not the others, they said, not the portraits that had been shot at the synagogue after the marriage ceremony, which were truly marvelous, pictures they would cherish for years to come. But the stuff from the wedding party was incomprehensible. So dark and raw, so unflattering. Everyone looked so sinister and unhappy. Even the laughing people looked vaguely demonic. And why were the shots so off-kilter? Why was everything so severely underlit? Miffed by the rebuke, Ferguson's mother sent the newlyweds copies of the portraits with a short accompanying note that read, "Glad you liked these," sent another batch to Aunt Pearl, another batch to her parents, and a last one to Mildred and Paul. After receiving his package, her brother-in-law called to ask why she hadn't included anything from the wedding party. "Because those pictures stink," she said. "All artists are revolted by their work," her new supporter and advocate replied, and eventually Ferguson's mother was persuaded to develop 30 prints from the more than 500 images she had shot that afternoon and mail them to Paul's office at Random House. 3 days later, he called back to say that not only did they not stink, but that he found them remarkable. With her permission, he was going to give them to Minor Weight on Aperture magazine. "They deserve to be published," he said, "to be seen by people who cared about photography. And since he knew White a little bit, why not start at the top?" Ferguson's mother wasn't sure if Paul meant what he was saying, or if he merely felt sorry for her. She thought, "Kind man steps in to help lost and grieving relative in her time of trouble. Man with connections seeks to connect unconnected widow photographer to a new life." Then she thought, pity or no pity, Paul was the one who had sent her down to New Orleans. And while he could have been acting on a whim, or on blind intuition, or on some long-shot hunch, now that the grumpy, alcoholic Wilmot had lauded her for doing, quote, "one hell of a damned fine job," perhaps her brother-in-law believed he had put his money on the right horse. Whether Paul influenced their decision or not, the editorial board at Aperture accepted her pictures for publication. A portfolio of 21 prints that appeared 6 months later under the title Jewish Wedding, Brooklyn. That triumph and the jolt of exaltation that shot through her when the letter from Aperture showed up in the mail were soon tempered by frustration, however, and then nearly destroyed by anger, since she couldn't publish the photos without securing releases from the people who were in them. And Ferguson's mother made the mistake of contacting Charlotte first, who stubbornly refused to allow those, quote, "grotesque snapshots of herself and Nathan to be published in Aperture or any other, quote, cruddy magazine." Over the next 3 days, Ferguson's mother spoke to all the other participants, among them Charlotte's mother and her twin sister Betty, and when no one else raised any objections, she called Charlotte back and asked her to reconsider. "Out of the question. Go to hell. Who do you think you are?" Aunt Pearl tried to reason with her. Ferguson's grandfather scolded her for what he called a selfish disregard of others. Betty called her a pinhead and a priss, but the new Mrs. Birnbaum wouldn't budge. The three pictures with Charlotte and Nathan in them were therefore scrapped. Three others were chosen to take their place, and a photo story about a wedding was published with no bride or groom anywhere in sight. Nevertheless, it was a start, a first step toward living in the only future that made sense to her. And Ferguson's mother forged on, emboldened by the publication of those photos to pursue other non-commissioned projects, her own work, as she called it, which continued to be found in the pages of Aperture, and sometimes between the covers of books or on the walls of galleries. And the most important element of that transformation was perhaps the last-minute decision she made before the appearance of Jewish Wedding, all the way back in the spring of 1956, when she got down on her knees before her bed and asked Stanley to forgive her for what she was about to do. "But it had to be this way," she said to him. "Any other way would force her to go on living in the ashes of the Newark fire until she too was burned up into nothing." And so it was, and so it continued to be for all the years of her future life, that she signed her work Rose Adler. In the beginning, the 8-year-old Ferguson was only dimly aware of what his mother was up to. He understood that she was busier than she had been, out and about on most days working at various photography jobs, or else locked up in what had once been the spare bedroom, which she had turned into a place for developing pictures and which was always sealed shut because of the fumes from the chemicals. And though it was good to see that she was smiling more and laughing more than she had during the spring and summer, the rest of what was happening was not good, not at all good as far as he was concerned. The spare bedroom had been his room for more than 8 months, his own private retreat where he could sort through his baseball cards and knock down plastic pins with his plastic bowling ball and throw beanbags through the holes in the wooden target and aim darts at the small red bullseye. And now it was gone, which could hardly be called a good thing. And then, sometime in late October, not long after his bright room had been transformed into an out-of-bounds dark room, another not-good thing occurred when his mother told him it would no longer be possible for her to pick him up after school. She would continue to take him there in the morning, but she couldn't count on being free in the afternoon anymore, and so his grandmother would be the one to meet him at the front steps and escort him back to the apartment. Ferguson didn't like it, since he was opposed to any and all change as a matter of strict moral doctrine. But he wasn't in a position to protest. He had to do what he was told. And what had once been the best part of the day? Seeing his mother again after 6.5 hours of boredom, reprimands, and bitter struggles with the Almighty, was turned into a dull plod westward with his fat, waddling Nana, an old woman so shy and so withheld that she never knew what to say to him, which meant that more often than not, they rode back home in silence. He couldn't help it. His mother was the only person he cared about or felt comfortable with, and everyone else grated on his nerves. The people in his family had their good points, he supposed, in that they all seemed to like him. But his grandfather was too loud, his grandmother was too quiet, Aunt Mildred was too bossy, Uncle Paul was too fond of listening to his own voice, Great Aunt Pearl was too smothering in her affections, Cousin Betty was too brash, Cousin Charlotte was too stupid, Little Cousin Eric was too rambunctious, Little Cousin Judy was too much of a crybaby. And the one relative he would have given anything to see again, his cousin Francie, was a college student in faraway California. As for his classmates at Hilliard, he had no real friends, only acquaintances. And even Dougie Hayes, the boy he saw more than anyone else, laughed at things that weren't funny and never understood a joke when he heard one. Except for his mother, it was hard for Ferguson to attach himself to any of the people he knew, since he always felt alone when he was with them, although being alone with others was probably a little less terrible than being alone with himself, which invariably seemed to push his thoughts back to the same old obsessions, as with his constant begging of God to produce a miracle that would finally put his mind at rest, or, even more insistently, with the photograph in the Newark Star-Ledger that he wasn't supposed to have looked at but did, studying it for 3 or 4 minutes while his mother left the room to fetch a pack of cigarettes. The picture with the caption that read, "The Scorched Remains of Stanley Ferguson." And there was his dead father in the burned-down building that had once been Three Brothers' homeworld, his body stiff and black and no longer human, as if the fire had turned him into a mummy. A man with no face and no eyes and a mouth wide open, as if locked in the middle of a scream. And that charred, mummified corpse had been put in a coffin and buried in the ground. And whenever Ferguson thought about his father now, that was the first thing he saw in his mind, the scorched remains of the black, half-incinerated body, with the open mouth still screaming from the bowels of the earth. "It's going to be a cold day, Archie. Remember to wear your scarf to school." Morbid ruminations were among the not good things that belonged to that rough year of being 8 and turning 9. But there were some good things as well, even things that happened every day, such as the after-school television program that ran from 4 o'clock to 5:30 on Channel 11. 90 straight minutes, with commercial interruptions, of old Laurel and Hardy movies, which turned out to be the finest, funniest, most satisfying movies ever made. It was a new show that had been launched in the fall. And until Ferguson accidentally turned it on one afternoon in October, he'd known nothing about that ancient comedy team, since Laurel and Hardy had been mostly forgotten by 1955. Their films from the 20s and 30s were never shown in theaters anymore, and it was only because of television that they were starting to make a comeback among the little people of the greater metropolitan area. how Ferguson came to adore those two idiots, those grown men with the minds of six-year-olds, brimming with eagerness and goodwill, and yet always quarreling and tormenting each other, always falling into the most improbable and dangerous predicaments, nearly drowned, nearly blown to bits, nearly brained into oblivion, and yet always managing to survive, hapless husbands, bumbling schemers, losers to the last, and yet, in spite of all their punching and pinching and kicking, what good friends they were, bound together more tightly than any other pair in the book of terrestrial life, each one an inseparable half of a single, two-part human organism. Mr. Laurel and Mr. Hardy. It pleased Ferguson immensely that those were the names of the real men who played the make-believe characters of Laurel and Hardy in the films. For Laurel and Hardy were always Laurel and Hardy, no matter what circumstances they happened to find themselves in, whether they lived in America or another country, whether they lived in the past or the present, whether they were furniture movers or fishmongers or Christmas tree salesmen or soldiers or sailors or convicts or carpenters or street musicians or stable hands or prospectors in the Wild West. And the fact that they were always the same, even when they were different, seemed to make them more real than any other characters in movies. For if Laurel and Hardy were always Laurel and Hardy, Ferguson reasoned, that must have meant they were eternal. They were his steadiest, most reliable companions all during that year and well into the next. Stanley and Oliver, a.k.a. Stan and Ollie, the thin one and the fat one, the feeble-minded innocent and the puffed-up fool, who in the end was no less feeble-minded than the first. And while it meant something to Ferguson that Laurel's first name was the same as his father's, it didn't mean that much, and surely it had little or nothing to do with his growing fondness for his new friends, who in no time at all had become his best friends, if not his only friends. What he loved most about them were the bedrock elements that never varied from film to film, beginning with the Cuckoo's theme song in the opening credits, which announced that the boys were back for another adventure and what would they think of next. The familiar turns that never grew tiresome to him, Ollie's tie twiddles and exasperated looks into the camera, Stan's dumbfounded blinks and sudden tears, the gags that revolved around their bowler hats, the too big one on Laurel's head, the too small one on Hardy's, the smashed-in hats and burning hats, the hats yanked down over the ears, and the hats stomped underfoot. Their propensity for falling down manholes and crashing through broken floorboards, for stepping into muddy bogs and neck-high puddles, their bad luck with automobiles, ladders, gas ovens, and electric sockets, Ollie's blowhard gentility when talking to strangers, "This is my friend, Mr. Laurel." Stan's nonsensical gift for igniting his thumb and puffing on non-existent but functioning pipes, their out-of-control laughing jags, their penchant for breaking into spontaneous dance routines, both so light on their feet, their unanimity of purpose when confronting their adversaries, all bickering and discord forgotten as they pull together to destroy a man's house or wreck a man's car, but also the variations on who they were and how their identity sometimes overlapped and even merged, as when Ollie rubbed Stan's foot thinking it was his own foot and sighed with pleasure and relief, or the ingenious ways in which they sometimes duplicated themselves, as when Big Stanley and Big Oliver babysat their toddler sons, Little Stan and Little Ollie, who were miniature replicas of their fathers since Laurel and Hardy played both sets of roles, or when Stan was married to a female Ollie and Ollie to a female Stan, or when they met their long-lost twin brothers, close friends whose names were, of course, Laurel and Hardy, or, best of all, when a blood transfusion went wrong at the end of a film and Stan wound up with Ollie's mustache and voice and the smooth-faced Hardy collapsed into a Laurel crying fit. Yes, they were ever so droll and inventive, and yes, Ferguson's stomach sometimes ached from laughing so hard at their buffoonery. But why he found them laughable, and why his love for them began to flower beyond all reason, had less to do with their clownish antics than their persistence, with the fact that they reminded Ferguson of himself. Strip away the comic exaggerations and slapstick violence, and Laurel and Hardy's struggles were no different from his own. They, too, blundered from one ill-conceived plan to the next. They, too, suffered through countless setbacks and frustrations. And whenever misfortune brought them to the snapping point, Hardy's angers would become his angers. Laurel's befuddlements would mirror his befuddlements. And the best thing about the botches they made for themselves was that Stan and Ollie were even more incompetent than he was, more stupid, more asinine, more helpless. And that was funny. So funny that he couldn't stop laughing at them, even as he pitied them and embraced them as brothers, kindred spirits forever smacked down by the world and forever standing up to try again, by hatching another one of their harebrained plans, which, inevitably, would knock them to the ground once more. Most of the time, he watched the films alone, sitting on the floor in the living room about a yard from the television set, which his mother and grandmother both considered to be too close, since the rays emitted by the cathode tube would ruin his eyes. Whenever one of them caught him in that position, he would have to remove himself to the more distant sofa. On the days when his mother was still out working when he returned home from school, his grandmother would stay with him in the apartment until his mother came back from her daily duties, as the nursemaid put it in the music box, complaining to a policeman after Stan had planted his shoe in her rear end, "He kicked me right in the middle of my daily duties." But Ferguson's grandmother had no interest in Laurel and Hardy. Her passion was for cleanliness and domestic order. And once she had given her grandson his post-school snack, generally two chocolate chip cookies and a glass of milk, but sometimes a plum or an orange or a stack of saltines that Ferguson would coat with dabs of grape jelly, he would go off to the living room to turn on his program, and she would busy herself with scrubbing down kitchen counters or scouring off crud from the stove burners or cleaning the sinks and toilets in the two bathrooms. A dedicated destroyer of filth and germs who never grumbled about her daughter's shortcomings as a housekeeper, but nevertheless sighed often as she went about these tasks, no doubt chagrined that her own flesh and blood did not adhere to her rigorous standards of sanitary living. On the days when Ferguson's mother was already at home when he returned from school, his grandmother would simply drop him off and leave, exchanging a kiss and a few words with her daughter, but rarely pausing long enough to go to the trouble of taking off her coat. And when his mother wasn't developing pictures in her darkroom or preparing dinner in the kitchen, she would occasionally join her son on the sofa and watch Laurel and Hardy with him, now and then laughing as hard as he did, at the daily duties line in the music box, for example, which became a private joke between them, a term that eventually replaced the old words they had used to refer to the human posterior, a long list that had included such dependable idioms as backside, torus, keister, hiney, rear end, fanny, and rump. As with the question his mother would sometimes ask when they were in different rooms, calling out, "What are you up to, Archie?" And if he wasn't standing or walking or lying down somewhere in the apartment, he would respond, "I'm sitting on my daily duties, Ma." But most often she would merely chuckle at Stan and Ollie's pranks and pratfalls, or give a little smile. And when things started to get out of hand, with whacks and thwacks and painful blows, she would wince or else shake her head and say, "Oh, Archie, that's just awful." Not meaning that the film was awful, but that the roughhousing was too excessive for her. Ferguson didn't agree, of course, but he was old enough to understand that it was possible for someone not to like Laurel and Hardy as much as he did. And he felt she was a good sport for sitting there with him, since he knew that Stan and Ollie were too dumb and childish for her, and that even if she watched them every day for a year, she would never become a fan. Only one person in the family shared his enthusiasm. Just one grown-up had the acuity to recognize the genius of his beloved imbeciles, and that was his grandfather, the elusive Benji Adler, who had always been something of a mystery to Ferguson, a man who seemed to possess two or three different personalities, effusive and generous on some days, shut down and distracted on other days, at times nervous, even jittery and short-tempered, at times calm and expansive, by turns warmly attentive to his grandson and almost indifferent to him. But on his good days, the days when he was in one of his spirited moods and the jokes were flying out of his mouth, He was a sterling companion, a co-conspirator in what Ferguson thought of as the Boer War, B-O-R-E, his scrambled incarnation of the misheard and misunderstood Boer War, which he took to be a militant assault against the dullness of life. In late November, Uncle Paul sent Ferguson's mother on another trip, this time all the way out to New Mexico, to photograph Millicent Cunningham, an 80-year-old poet who was about to publish her collected essays with Random House. And during her absence, Ferguson holed up at his grandparents' apartment near Columbus Circle. He had been living in Laurel and Hardy Land for more than a month by then, entirely dug in with his new infatuation, and nearly bereft when weekends rolled around now, since the program was off the air on Saturday and Sunday. But the first night he spent at West 58th Street happened to be a Monday, which gave him five straight afternoons of Mr. Fat and Mr. Thin. And when his grandfather came home early from work on the first afternoon, explaining that it had been a slow day at the office, he plunked himself down on the sofa next to Ferguson to watch the program, which seemed to affect his 62-year-old mind in the same way it affected Ferguson's 8-year-old mind. And before long, he was shuddering with laughter, at one point so excessively that he began to wheeze and cough and turn red in the face. And so thorough was his delight that he came home early from the office every day that week to catch the show with his grandson. Then came the surprise, the Sunday visit in early December, when Ferguson's grandparents walked into the apartment on Central Park West, loaded down with packages. Some of them so heavy that Arthur, the superintendent of the building, had to wheel them in on a hand truck, which earned him a $5 tip from Ferguson's grandfather. $5. And another one in an exceedingly long cardboard box that his grandparents carried in together, each one grasping an end with two hands. And so long was the box that it nearly didn't make it into the apartment. When he saw his grandmother smile, how rarely she smiled, and heard his grandfather laugh, and felt his mother's hand settle onto his right shoulder, he knew that something exceptional was about to happen. But he had no idea what that thing could be until the packages were unwrapped and he discovered that he now owned a 16mm movie projector, a roll-up movie screen with a collapsible tripod base, and copies of 10 Laurel and Hardy shorts, The Finishing Touch, Two Tars, Wrong Again, Big Business, Perfect Day, Blotto, Below Zero, Another Fine Mess, Helpmates, and Toad in a Hole. Little matter that the projector had been bought secondhand. It worked. Little matter that the prints were scratched and the sound sometimes seemed to be coming from the bottom of a bathtub. The films were watchable. And with the films came a whole new set of words for him to master. Sprocket, for example, which turned out to be a far better word to think about than scorched. On the weekends when his mother wasn't out of town on an assignment, and the weather wasn't too cold or too wet or too windy, most Saturday mornings and afternoons were spent prowling the streets in search of good photographs. Ferguson trotting along beside his mother as she strode down the sidewalks of Manhattan, or mounted the steps of municipal buildings, or scaled rocks or crossed bridges in Central Park. And then, for no reason that was ever apparent to him, she would come to a sudden halt, aim her camera at something, press the shutter release, and click, 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 click. Which wasn't the most absorbing activity in the world, perhaps, but it belonged to the pleasure of being with his mother, of having her all to himself again. And how not to enjoy the lunches they ate together in coffee shops along Broadway and on 6th Avenue in the Village, where 10 times out of 10 he would order a hamburger and a chocolate milkshake. Always the same meal at the midpoint of those Saturday excursions. A hamburger, please. Yes, a hamburger, please. As if it were part of a sacred ritual, which meant it could never vary in any way down to the smallest detail. And then the Saturday evenings and or Sunday afternoons, when they went to the movies together, sitting in the balcony where his mother could smoke her Chesterfields, movies that were never Laurel and Hardy movies, but new productions from Hollywood such as It's Always Fair Weather, The Tall Men, Picnic, Guys and Dolls, Artists and Models, The Court Jester, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Searchers, Forbidden Planet, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, Armis Brooks, Bowani Junction, Trapeze, Moby Dick, The Solid Gold Cadillac, The Ten Commandments, Around the World in 80 Days, Funny Face, The Incredible Shrinking Man, Fear Strikes Out, and 12 Angry Men. The good and bad films of 1955, 1956, and 1957 that carried them through his time at Hilliard and on into his first year at the next school he attended, the Riverside Academy. On West End Avenue between 84th and 85th Streets, a co-ed institution of so-called progressive tendencies that had been founded 29 years earlier, exactly 100 years after the founding of Hilliard.